Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity wrapping up his vacation. Dan Foster of National Review Online once again very ably filling in for Jim as we wrap up the week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan, just yesterday we talked about how the president was taking heat from the Congressional Black Caucus of all organizations. Now we see Nancy Pelosi, who represents the heart of San Francisco, not exactly a swing district, holding a town hall meeting and trying to explain why she supported ultimately the debt ceiling compromise. And as you can hear from this audio, it's pretty clear that this didn't go over very well among her constituents.
When we pass this bill, which I did not like at all, but rather than have our government default, we did. We got so upset because of the following. Because default is worse, but because I didn't like the bill.
Dan, you heard Satan Sandwich, if you listen carefully, and they're thrown in a couple of times. Nancy Pelosi trying to do her best John Kerry there. I really hated the bill, but I supported it anyway. She goes on to say that, you know, we didn't want a default. We didn't end up cutting anything from entitlement programs, so it was better than defaulting. So summer has not been good for the Democrats since the Obama administration started. First, you had the town hall meetings in 2009 where the constituents knew the contents of the House bill way better than any of the members did, and they didn't like it very much at all. Last year, of course, we had the build-up to the midterm elections where the Democrats got trounced. And now, of course, we've got a horrible economy and the Democratic base upset with their people for not sticking to their principles, which leaves Pelosi and Obama in kind of a pickle. The independents don't think they're nearly responsible enough, and their base doesn't think they're nearly liberal enough. I'm not sure where that leaves them.
Yeah, the one thing that structurally that Nancy Pelosi and Obama have in common is that they both relied on and continue to rely on a very fired up liberal base to go out there and do their ground game and generate enthusiasm and create a lot of buzz. I mean, Nancy Pelosi is torn in two different directions. She's, as you said, elected by three quarters of San Francisco, and the most liberal three quarters of those three quarters of San Francisco. So, but at the same time, she, you know, so that would seem to be an easy constituency to serve. Just vote, you know, whatever the leftmost position is on an issue, take it. But she's also pulled it in a different direction, which is that she's the minority leader who reports to the President of the United States and who's interested in regaining the majority. I don't necessarily give the Republicans credit for doing this on purpose, but what they were able to do is force the Democrats to compromise against their liberal base and then have folks like Pelosi not just vote for the bill herself, but provide a lot of the votes to get it passed. And they've been able to secure an outcome on the debt ceiling in this case that also ticks off that very base that Democrats and President Obama are going to rely on to be fired up in 2012. I don't give Speaker Boehner credit for being that much of a Machiavellian, but it's certainly an interesting and salutary side effect of this whole situation. And one last thing is that, you know, politics and managing your base is all about managing their expectations. And the Republicans were able to do a much better job of that. There was a lot of hollering from Tea Partiers about the bill not being good enough. But from the word go, Republicans were saying, we're going to hold firm on tax increases. The rest we're willing to put on the table, and we're going to negotiate the best bill possible. Democrats came out and said that the Boehner plan, which already represented a compromise on a compromise from the Republican standpoint, was a Satan sandwich. Well, you reap what you sow, Nancy.
Absolutely right. Well, for those of you liberals, and I'm sure many, many liberals are listening to this, there are some heroes, and I put that in air quotes for you, who did not support the final deal, one of them being New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg. And in case you had any illusions about Frank Lautenberg's commitment to soaking the rich, well, he pretty much dispelled any of those yesterday. He took a question about the environment and turned it into an issue of why we need to get a whole lot more money from the rich, himself included. And then he, of course, cozied up to Warren Buffett and basically, in plain English, says we need to get rid of the rich. Listen here.
Go to Warren Buffett. You heard him say it the other day. The richest man in America is not second or third. And he said we ought to pay more for the privileges that we will be have in this country. And it's a tough fight, but we gotta eliminate the waste. We gotta eliminate the fraudulent practice.
Got to eliminate the rich. Well, you first, sir. You can contribute along with Warren Buffett as much as you would like to the U.S. Treasury to pay down the debt, since you don't feel like you're paying your fair share. I'll give him credit, Dan, for at least putting it right out there that that's what they want to do, is to get rid of the rich, get rid of job creators, and I guess that probably shouldn't leave them scratching their heads about why we're over 9% unemployment.
One of my favorite movies of all time is The Edge. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Greg, but it's Alec Baldwin and Anthony Hopkins fighting a giant bear in the Alaska wilderness. Now, I will quickly try and make the connection here, but there's a great line where Alec Baldwin is feeling sorry for the billionaire Anthony Hopkins. So it must be tough for you with all that money, not knowing who your real friends are and who just wants something from you. And Hopkins' reply is, "Never feel sorry for a man who owns his own plane." Well, when I heard this, Lautenberg line, my first thought was, I'm supposed to listen to a guy on the rich who's got a rail station named after him in Secaucus, New Jersey, a $500 million railroad station named after him. He's also one of the 10 wealthiest people on Capitol Hill with a net personal net worth of about $50 million. I can't imagine he means by his statement that his money should be taken away from him and he should be brought down to the level of the average middle-class taxpayer. So I don't know what he's really saying beyond the standard, historically flawed, short-memory liberal line, which is that it's always a revenue problem. There is no such thing as a bad government program, just an underfunded one.
Kudos to The Edge for making an important point. I'm going to throw one of my own here as we head into the third martini. I think clearly the worst goodwill match ever to go horribly wrong was Apollo Creed versus Ivan Drago in Rocky IV, when it turned into Apollo Creed dying. But we did get a great fight between Rocky and Drago later in the fight. Well, on the heels of that, Georgetown University, its basketball team, in China for a series of exhibition games, all in coordination with Vice President Joe Biden's visit to China. And I guess this will take away from any ridiculous gaffes that Biden has made over the past 48 hours, but this basketball game turned into a brawl. And that went on for several minutes until the fans started throwing bottles onto the court, so Georgetown eventually left. These two teams will actually play again over the weekend in Shanghai, so that could be interesting. Dan, obviously, goodwill not exactly achieved in this matchup.
Biden goes to China, and within 24 hours, there's open warfare between Americans and Chinese. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence. But in seriousness, what I've read about this brawl is that there was hilariously lopsided foul calls against the United States. Now, I wasn't there. I didn't see the game. There's one of two ways to read that. One was suggested to me by a reader, and one's just was my first thought, is that, of course, the Chinese, you know, they're going to make sure that this game is at least competitive. The Chinese officials, they're going to make sure the game's at least competitive, or preferably that they win it, by calling everything possible on the U.S. team. And this has shades of some of the awful, awful, just objectively awful calls we saw against Team USA in the Men's World Cup last year, which, if there was ever a chance that United States was going to get into soccer, that pretty much put the last nail in the coffin. So that was my first thought with this thing. But somebody else pointed out to me, and this could very well be true too, that the Chinese might just play really traditional 1950s-style basketball and call things to the letter. In the United States, basketball has evolved in a little bit of a different direction. I mean, traveling in the NBA, for instance, traveling's not called as strictly as it might be, palming the ball, things like that. Pivot, you moving your pivot foot, things like that. So I don't know which one it was, but I do know that there's a snapshot of about four Chinese players stomping on a Georgetown Hoya while he's on the ground that doesn't make it look like it was much of a fair fight.
Yeah, probably not. Also, shades, if you go way back to 72 when the Soviets got three chances to beat the U.S. at the Olympic Games, but not that we're holding a grudge over 40 years or anything like that.
Yeah.
Dan, it's been great being with you this week. Thanks for filling in for Jim. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Dan Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Monday. Jim Garrity will be back for the Three Martini Lunch.